Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Kate Maxwell. Kate was born in London and has worked as a journalist and editor in both London and New York. Her first novel, Hush, was shortlisted for the Bridport Prize Peggy Chapman Andrews Award. Welcome to Our Shelves, Kate. It's really lovely to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start by talking a little bit about Hush, your debut novel, which is being published by Virago next month. And in it, you've got a central protagonist named Stevie, and she's a single, unattached woman in her late 30s who is living the kind of dream in New York. She's got a brilliant job. She's got a load of wonderful friends, but she decides that she really wants to have a baby and that time is kind of running out. So she decides to relocate back to London, where she's from, and find a sperm donor and kind of make a go of it by herself. But then when the baby arrives, things don't really go according to plan, do they? She finds herself struggling and wondering whether she's actually made quite a huge mistake. And I'm so fascinated to find out what it was about this particular side of motherhood, which I think is probably a side we don't really hear talked about that much. Was it that really interested you about this?
I think it was, yes. I think you're right. I think with a couple of exceptions that perhaps we'll talk about, I don't think that the realities of early motherhood have been covered all that much in fiction. And there are a couple of taboos I wanted to take on as well. First of all, the love at first sight myth, the idea that everyone automatically falls in love with their baby the minute they clap eyes on him or her, which doesn't always happen and doesn't happen for Stevie. And also the expectation that women transition seamlessly from one life to another when they have children. In Stevie's case, from independence to and a big job to looking after a tiny baby. And it's a huge change, I think, and can have a huge impact on one's sense of self. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily come naturally to everyone and it can take time. I think more recently, a few books, perhaps nonfiction more than fiction, but have taken on some of these themes. I haven't read the book, actually, but I've seen the film The Lost Daughter, Elena Ferrante's book, which obviously talks about sort of maternal ambivalence. The character leaves her children for 3 years to pursue her career. You know, it's extremely uncomfortable watch, really. I thought it was a brilliant film, but that introduces the idea of, I think she calls herself an unnatural mother. Mm. So, you know, some of these themes are being explored, but yes, when I came to write the book, I did think that they were sort of conflicts and nuanced aspects of motherhood that perhaps needed a bit more attention.
I think you're completely right. And they still feel, even those great examples you've given us, they still feel very taboo subjects, don't they? I mean, like, you know, part of the appeal or the sort of intrigue around the Ferrante story and then obviously the film is the fact that it's exploring this quite kind of tricky subject. And people do feel, I think they still feel quite uncomfortable with these revelations from women that, you know, everything is not perfect as a mother or that you might have some kind of sense of ambivalence, which seems crazy when we let men have an awful lot of ambivalence about, you know, having children and giving up their lives, or the idea of giving up certain things to have a child, and kind of maybe abandoning their families, you know, because they decide they don't want to do it anymore.
I completely agree. I think if a man decides to go off and, you know, on some big job for a few years, I don't think people would bat an eyelid, or certainly not to the same extent that they do it with Elena Ferrante's book. I think motherhood is still it's a sacred institution. It's so venerated. It has been for millennia. Caring for children is seen as something that's innate in women. And the idea that you might not bond with your child immediately is laden with guilt, I think, and shame.
And I guess particularly for, for women like you're talking about, like Stevie, who have very successful lives before they become mothers. And one automatically assumes, in a sense, that these women who live these brilliant lives might go on to very smooth transitions into motherhood and be very successful at that. And it comes as a surprise to Stevie in the novel that it's not plain sailing, and it does have, you know, issues. But she's really fascinating because there is this other... You know, the book is very brilliantly told, that you've got the kind of storyline in the present where she's got her new baby and she's trying to kind of, you know, bond with him. But then you've also got this kind of backstory folding out behind her of her time in New York and this very, very different life that she lived. And I'm not for a minute suggesting that you are Stevie or Stevie is you, but clearly, I think from reading your CV, you must have drawn a little bit on your own experience of moving to New York and working in quite a kind of high powered environment for Stevie's backstory. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I worked in New York for about 6 years, first at Condé Nast Traveler magazine and then at a travel startup. And yes, it was a fantastic time. And I certainly drew on my experiences of living in the city, when I was writing those bits of the novel, and really enjoyed going back to New York, because when I was writing, I was writing from London, and I had two small children. I was living a very different life from Stevie's life.
I was going to say, did it make you feel nostalgic, kind of revisiting old haunts, or kind of, you know, on the page, or did it make you feel, was it kind of better, do you think, to have a bit of distance between you and your past, both kind of, you know, geographically and in terms of time, to be able to write about it or fictionalize it in this way?
Probably, yes. I think I did feel nostalgic, though. Yes, I mean, I really fell in love with New York when I lived there. I really fell in love with the city itself. I remember the first sort of couple of months I lived there, partly because I was just terrified of taking the metro, the subway. I thought I was going to get lost. I walked everywhere, so I walked from Chelsea, from downtown Manhattan, where I was living at the time, all the way up to Times Square to the Condé Nast building, and was blown away by the architecture and, you know, the tall buildings and the wide avenues and the way the sun sort of bounced off the buildings. And yeah, it was a really wonderful time. And
it seems like a bit of a cliche to say it, but I think the book as well, to me, it felt a bit like a love letter to the city. Like you depict New York so brilliantly, I think, in the book. You talk about how the way the characters, I love the way they talk about the city and they talk about their lives in the city. And it really made me really kind of think that I really want to go and live in New York at some point. Let's put it that way.
That was definitely, yeah, part of the idea. And really, I think Stevie, you know, she has a relationship. I don't want to give too much away, but really she falls in love with her job, and she falls, you know, she falls for the city. So yes, I think love letter to New York is a great description.
You've explained that this is a side of motherhood that you wanted to talk about, but can you tell me a little bit in a little bit more detail about where the initial kind of nugget or idea came from to write this particular novel, Kate?
Yes, so the idea came from conversations I had with friends when we were in our early 30s and living in New York. We had jobs we really enjoyed. I was working for Condé Nast Traveler and a travel startup. And we were mostly single. There were no sort of particularly significant people in our lives. And we talk about whether we wanted to have children, and if so, how we'd go about it. And we talked about egg freezing and sperm donation and adoption. And my own route to motherhood was fairly conventional in the end. But I thought it might be interesting to take that idea and sort of run with it and think about what the ramifications of a woman who had a child on her own and left her life and career to do that might be, and see where she ended up. And that's how I ended up with Stevie.
Did you know any of your friends who have chosen this route or something more similar to this route than yourself?
Yes, I do know people who've chosen this route.
And did you find yourself sort of drawing on their experiences, or were you writing entirely from fiction at this point?
Not particularly, no. She's her own character with her own backstory, which explains to an extent, you know, why she finds it difficult to bond with her child, which is obviously one of the themes of the book.
Talk about a few other things in the novel later on in this episode, but let's dive into the main questions now. First up, Kate, I'd love you to tell me about a couple of books that are currently on your bedside table.
So first of all, my first book is What I Loved by Siri Hustvedt. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Lucy, but this is actually a reread for me. I first read it about 7 years ago, and I think it came out in about 2003. And it's a New York novel. It is set in Manhattan, in Soho, from the 70s, I think, till about the 90s. And it follows two/three couples, actually, because there's a divorce. Leo and Erica and Bill and Lucille and then his second wife Violet. They all work in this sort of art scene in New York. Bill is a painter. Leo, who narrates the book, is an art historian. And it's in three quite distinct parts. The first part introduces the characters and their sort of intermingled lives, making crazy art, all that kind of stuff, living in lofts in Soho, one above the other. And having children, Mark and Matthew, in quick succession. And then the second part begins very abruptly with a death. And even though this is the second time I was reading this book, I gasped. I mean, I think it's one of the most shocking lines I can think of, really, in sort of contemporary literature. And that death, and then there's another death at the end of the book, actually, at the end of that section. Sets the scene for the second section, and everyone is kind of coming to terms with it and dealing with it in different ways. It's incredibly heartbreaking. And then the third part of the book, which is one of the reasons I really like it, is completely different in tone, really. It's sort of part thriller, part murder mystery. It's really pacey. You know, you're following these characters, or the remaining characters, one of the sons in particular, Mark, who is quite sort of unknowable even to himself. Really, it's a book about sort of loss and love. And I think the way I interpreted it, it's quite complex, and it's got a lot of quite complex imagery as well. But was really about it's about our perceptions of each other, really, and how we experience people and events in different ways, and how we project our expectations of people onto them, what we see and what eludes us. And I just think it's really beautifully written. It's in quite sort of plain, unfussy prose. But yeah, it's just a wonderful story about complex relationships. And I'm sort of embarking on my second book at the moment, and there are definitely some complex relationships in there, and a couple of deaths as well. So part of the reason I picked this up was sort of out of inspiration, looking for inspiration. And it certainly delivered on that. So I thoroughly recommend it.
That's a brilliant recommendation. Do you remember when you first read it? You're saying it's a reread, was it?
Yes, actually. I remember I was on holiday in Mexico with my husband and our one-year-old. And I have very clear recollections of reading it, and again feeling it completely heartbroken by, you know, some aspects of the book, but just, you know, just so impressed with the way it develops, and that you know, really compelling third section. It's a beautiful literary novel, I suppose, and, you know, obviously set in New York, one of my favorite places.
Do you often go back and reread sort of favorite novels, or, as you say, is this specifically because you're hoping it will lead to some kind of inspiration?
I don't often, actually. I mean, I do read a lot of very contemporary stuff. There are a couple of authors I reread, like Virginia Woolf. Always have time for her. But no, I have been thinking recently that it's a good idea to reread, you know, classics or books that have really influenced you in the past, and remember why you like them. And so I think I'm going to do a bit more of that in the future.
I find it's always so fascinating when you read a book, particularly like something like this, where when you first read it, it made it had a real impact on you. And I'm always intrigued as to second time round whether it will have the same sort of impact or something different. And it sounds really fascinating that actually, like you say, that even if you know what's coming sort of plot wise, you're still quite taken aback by it in the moment. It's clearly exceptionally well written, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Incredibly powerful, absolutely. And I definitely saw different things and different imagery in it this time around.
Yeah, you're making me want to go back and reread it because it's been a while since I read it too. And what's your second novel? It's something a little bit different, isn't it?
Yes, the second one is The Bread the Devil Need by a writer called Lisa Allen Agostini. And the reason I came to this was because it's on the long list for the Women's Prize. And I think probably like lots of people, I always sort of aim to read the whole long list and obviously only manage, you know, I don't know, three or four or something. But
still good going. Still impressive.
But I thought this was wonderful, actually. It's a really beautiful, powerful book. It's set in Trinidad, in Port of Spain. Lisa Allen Agostini is, I think it's her first adult novel, actually. I think she's written a couple of YA novels, and she's also a stand-up comedian, impressively.
Oh, wow.
It's written in Trinidadian Creole, really lyrical. I think the writing really adds to, obviously, the sense of place and also the atmosphere. And it's, you know, it's on a really tough subject. And it's a tough read. It's about the cycle of sexual and violent abuse that the lead character, Alethea, has suffered since she was a young child. And it also talks about racism and colorism. She's singled out for having light skin. I think the reason I liked it really was because of this incredibly powerful character, Alethea. We meet her when she's nearing 40, but she looks much younger according to her. She lives with her partner, Leo, who beats her. She's having an affair with her boss from the fashion boutique that she works in, and she takes sort of refuge in books, which I really enjoyed. Doesn't really trust women because she's been hurt by them in the past. And when another woman is shot by her jealous lover outside the boutique that Alethea works at, she determines to change her ways and escape the situation that she's in. Her adopted brother, Colin, also sort of makes an appearance and sort of helps her with that. And I think the reason it was so effective was because, I mean, it's obviously a very serious subject, but it's not a depressing book at all. It's incredibly engaging and actually fairly upbeat, I found, despite the fact that really Alethea's abuse is kind of woven into her story in a sort of amazing way, really. I mean, you can sort of feel her wince because she's so conscious of you know, her violent past. There's one scene where a friend kind of jokingly throws a magazine at her and she sort of cowers. And there's definitely sort of humour in there as well. I think Agostine's very good at juxtaposition. So she'll be talking about Leo teaching Alethea to swim, and then she'll talk about the licks that Leo gives her, sort of pathos, I suppose. And, you know, it's a story about resilience and survival and the opportunity to escape. I thought it was really a really great read, and I hope it goes on to the shortlist.
We'll keep our fingers crossed. Next up, then, I think you're going to tell me about a particular TV series that you've been enjoying or watching at least recently, right?
Yes, it's on at the moment, actually. It's called We Crashed, which I think is a terrible name, but it's a very good series, highly entertaining. It's on Apple TV, and it's about the rise and fall of the office space company WeWork, again in New York. So this is the company that was valued at a whopping great $47 billion at its height, and then crashed, as you might imagine from the title of the series. My book is set in part in a co-working members club, not unlike WeWork. So naturally I was interested to see this series. It stars Jared Leto as this charismatic Israeli founder, and Anne Hathaway as his wife and sort of muse. And he's just sort of a founder whisperer. She's very new agey, and she's also the cousin of Gwyneth Paltrow in real life. So a great cast. And it begins with when Adam Newman is asked off his own board after a failed IPO of the company. And really, I don't know. I think it's just a sort of tale of sort of charisma and storytelling. I mean, Jared Leto's, it is just, you know, he's the most, he plays the most extraordinary founder. I mean, this is a man who, despite the fact that the company seems to be sort of incapable of turning any sort of profit or making any kind of amount of money, I mean, at some points it loses something like $2 million a day. He's just so persuasive at persuading these investors to invest huge amounts of money in the company. Rebecca, his wife, is a fantastic, fascinating character who calls him a supernova and tells him, really kind of eggs him on and tells him to do what he believes in and to build this community, which is inspired by his time living in a kibbutz, the happiest time of his life. And it's just interesting about, you know, the all-consuming work culture of New York of that time in the 2010s and the kind of blurring of work and play. There's some very entertaining scenes. They have one bit where they, a riff on TGI, Thank God It's Friday. So they have Thank God It's Monday, where they have tequila shots in the office and Adam is firing these T-shirts into the crowd and then it all goes slightly wrong at this summer camp that they all go on. But yet all these millennials who are kind of drinking the Kool-Aid and slash being slightly exploited and not being paid very much money, and you sort of wonder as well, you know, how genuine are the attempts by this duo to build this community, or are they just in it for the money? I suspect a bit more of the latter than the former. But Rebecca Anne Hathaway has a brilliant line where she says that their mission is to elevate the world's consciousness, which it's just so funny and far fetched. But you know, that becomes the company's mission statement. So, you know, it's pretty mind-boggling and hugely entertaining and a good watch. And also the story of a relationship, because Adam Neumann and Rebecca, you know, they have this amazing bond, and they're still together apparently, I think 5 or 6 children later, despite the failure of the company. It's a very interesting story.
Well, I have to say, you now sold it to me. I was a bit dubious before, I think slightly because it just felt like the whole sort of WeWork crash had happened so recently. And I'm always a bit dubious about sort of jumping on the really quick bandwagon to make a show about something which is, you know, not even history, let's put it that way. But you've sort of made me think that maybe I need to give it a go now and actually give it a bit of a chance if it's so well acted.
Give it a go. I mean, you know, it's glossy and glitzy and fun. And I think it's worth a watch.
I was going to ask, actually, I mean, I know you just mentioned it, but because, like you say, you've got this sort of startup in the book, this members club, which is obviously, and they're so keen on that idea of work. I love the bit in the novel where you have the sort of founder of that saying that, you know, this is a club about, this is the whole point of, you know, being at this club is so you can work and you can kind of, you know, work all hours. And obviously that wouldn't kind of work in London in quite the same way, because New York is this culture of kind of people wanting to work. And it sounds like that's quite similar to what is going on in WeWork. When you were writing your sort of fictional version of this startup, did you have anything in particular in mind? I mean, had you already been following what was happening at somewhere like WeWork? Was it kind of, you know, obviously that kind of thing was in the headlines and sort of everywhere we looked, and were you modeling it on certain real startups?
I worked at a startup in the sort of latter part of my time in New York. It was a tech startup. It was travel rather than this kind of thing. But yes, I definitely, you know, I have thought back to those days and that sort of feeling of being part of something and building something and working with a lot of very young, very driven people who really enjoyed work. And you know, it did feel very different from my time in London.
It feels already that you know, even though I've just said in a sense that it's such recent history as to me to not be that interested yet in watching the TV show, it does feel like it captures a particular time. Though reading the novel, I was so kind of taken of like, oh god, this is a kind of, even though I've never been personally involved in startups, I've known people who've worked for them, and this kind of culture has become so I think we're all so familiar with it now, these spaces. I don't know what their future is, obviously kind of post-pandemic, so maybe this was a particular time and place, right?
I think so, but I also think that post-pandemic, we've got to a stage now where I mean, I certainly am quite, you know, I've been at home for a couple of years now, and I would absolutely relish being being somewhere like we were.
Desperate to get back to other people.
Yeah, and I think actually also as enormous offices sort of slightly dissolve and big companies think maybe they don't need those sorts of spaces, that actually companies like WeWork will become more popular.
That's true, actually, I suppose. And when people do want to get out of the house, maybe even for a couple of days a week, but they don't want to necessarily commute all the way to the office, they might choose somewhere more kind of locally that they can access but isn't at home, right?
Exactly, where, you know, where they see other people, they can interact with other people and leave their kitchen tables.
Exactly. Arshelle's be back in just a moment.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I'm talking to Kate Maxwell about the joys of being back in the office and being able to leave the kitchen table. Next up, Kate, could you tell me about a book that made you think about feminism in a new way, please?
Sure. So I've chosen a work of fiction, which might not be your usual answer to this question, Lucy.
But anything and everything goes here, don't worry.
I've chosen Matrix by Lauren Groff, and I love Lauren Groff. I loved Fates and Furies, which is actually another book I've read more than once. Mm. I loved that dual narrative thing, you know, a marriage told from both perspectives, and the character Lotto's sort of creativity being undermined by his wife Mathilde. Mm. I thoroughly recommend that if you haven't read it. But Matrix is completely different. It is about the life of Marie de France. Not much is known about her. She was one of the first women to write in French. She was a poet. I think she was connected to the Plantagenet court and to Ellen of Aquitaine. And it's possible that she spent some time in an abbey. But that's about it. So Lauren Groff takes this character, and the reason that I was attracted to it and the sort of link to feminism is that because I think when I think about the medieval times, I think of women spinning, looking after children, surviving really, and not doing, particularly powerful stuff. But this book has made me think of that time as having potential for women to be powerful and to be leaders, because her character is exactly that. So she takes Marie de France and she expels her from the French court under Eleanor of Aquitaine, another powerful woman, and she sends her to England to an abbey. Marie is not pleased about this at all at first, but she comes around to it, and she really turns the fortunes of the abbey around, first as a prioress and eventually as an abbess. She does things like, she's really entrepreneurial, actually. She gets the nuns fishing for trout. She gets them spinning silk. She makes the people who rent the land pay up for the first time. She makes the abbey independent of men, and she gives nuns jobs according to their abilities rather than as a kind of form of penance as they had before, which very much I think fits with sort of modern theories of management. And she turns this abbey really into a kind of self-sufficient community and a feminist utopia. And but she's not entirely blameless. She's not just doing this for the love of God or for the love of Eleanor, who she is in love with. There's a lot of ego, or some ego at least, at stake as well. And she talks about sort of her legacy at times, and she even sort of crosses the line, really. She takes on the role of priest, and she gives mass and listens to confessions, which is obviously a complete no-no at that time. So I just thought it was a wonderful, she was a wonderful character, and utterly convincing, really. And even if, you know, Mary de France was a completely different character, I choose to believe Lauren Groff's account that she was this sort of powerful feminist. I think that the point really of historical fiction is to write these people who are often women back into history. And Matrix does that brilliantly.
There's something so freeing, surely, about being able to pick a historical figure like Marie, about someone, like you say, who very little is known, and then fill in the gaps and fill them in this kind of, you know, glorious way that you wouldn't be able to do with nonfiction, but that fiction gives you this opportunity to sort of invent a whole life, but have it based on reality, right?
Exactly. I sort of feel as if just enough was known about Marie, but she's basically a blank canvas for Lauren Groff, which is perfect.
Yeah.
I also love that the prose, it's sort of really rich and dense, and, you know, you've got this feeling of it brings to life the English countryside so wonderfully. You know, there was a line I wrote down, actually, that the hot, still August days with the struck iron shimmer of insect noise just gets you straight there. I think there's a lot of stench as well, because these nuns washed very seldom. But also the sort of scent of flowers in the English countryside, which I just loved.
It's kind of incredible, I think, that Lauren wrote this, because not only did she have to put herself in this, you know, completely different time period about very little known, but, you know, she's writing this from her home in Florida. She's not even here in the UK, and she's conjured up this wonderful, you know, 5th century England, right? And like you say, right down to the smells and the kind of the texture of life on a daily basis.
Absolutely. And you know, I always think that genre shifting is so impressive, and, you know, Fates and Furies was a contemporary novel, and this is just completely different, as you say. In fact, another historical novel that I have read fairly recently was Hamlet, which obviously is the wonderful story of Shakespeare's wife and son. And other children, by Maggie O'Farrell, and, you know, again, Maggie O'Farrell, I think that's her first historical novel, and she does it so brilliantly.
Have you read Margaret the First by Danielle Dutton? That's another one that I've enjoyed in the last few years.
I haven't.
It's really good. It takes, again, a sort of a real historical figure, Margaret, this woman, I can't remember what her surname was off the top of my head, but she was married to a sort of an English lord, but again, it sort of fills in the blanks that we don't know in history. It sort of, you know, evokes this entire very sort of decadent, fascinating kind of portrait of life at that time, but is also sort of slightly experimental. It's a very short novel, but it's you know, one of the best things I've read in a while. So
great, definitely put on there.
Then there we are, we've got some recommendations for listeners who haven't read Matrix first, and then move on to these other wonderful historical novels. And last question today, Kate, if I may, could you tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you particularly admire?
Yes, this is probably the hardest question of all, because there are so many.
Exactly. We like to end on a high, on a kind of a hard high, let's put it that way.
Yes. So I've chosen Josie Norton, who is the co-founder and CEO of Choose Love, which is a charity based in the UK. And the reason I've chosen her is because obviously, Ukraine is on my mind a lot at the moment. And as we enter another refugee crisis, with millions of people fleeing Ukraine, I've been thinking a lot about Josie Norton, who is someone that I met several years ago and interviewed. And she set up this amazing humanitarian organization in 2015, which was when the Syrian refugee crisis was at its height. She came from the music industry, completely different experience, absolutely no experience of charities or of any kind. And I think she decided over lunch, she was so moved by sort of seeing images of the Syrian refugee crisis, to start up a crowdfunding page and to take supplies to Calais and to the camp there. And she ended up working in the camps in Calais for quite a while. And then the charity is called Help Refugees Initiative was born. They've raised tens of millions for a grassroots organisation. So they don't, you know, they invest in existing organisations, whether that is rescue boats or some women's community projects. And they're now sort of raising an enormous amount of money for Ukraine. I think I read that they've already raised about $7 million. And I just think, you know, she's such an understated person. We've just been talking about Adam Newman, the founder of WeWork.
Opposite end of the spectrum, right?
Absolute opposite end of the spectrum, like a complete sort of some extrovert and a charismatic in every single way. Well, which is not to say that Josie's not charismatic, but you just feel that, you know, her heart is in exactly the right place. She talks about the contagious nature of compassion, which I think is quite interesting. She talks about, you know, people want to help and they want to give and they're moved by crises like these, but they don't know how. And she's really she's built a framework for people to do that in a very kind of sort of modern way, I suppose. She's used the sort of digital tools you know that are available now from social media. She's used that a lot for donations and to rally volunteers and to show people where their money's going. She's worked with the designer Catherine Hamnett to create sort of merchandise, which has raised a lot of money. She's had these amazing pop-up stores where you can buy real products.
I remember when they were one came to London a few years ago before Christmas, and you could technically go and buy Christmas presents there, but it was, you know, you donating the money to the charity, right?
Yes, and you leave with nothing. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very clever.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think it had been done before. And she's, you know, uses music partnerships. And I just think she's made, you know, a crisis and a cause that you know, refugees and displaced people around the world, which can be quite difficult to, I suppose, if I understand it, she's made it sort of tangible and easy to help with. And yes, I mean, all sorts of charities doing incredible work in Ukraine at the moment and around Ukraine. But, you know, she's definitely one to watch, and Tuesdog is one to watch. Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, you've given us some wonderful recommendations for books to read, recommendations for what to watch, and now recommendations on how to donate to help the cause in Ukraine. So that's what more could I ask for, basically. Thank you so much, Kate. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you for coming along.
Thank you so much for having me, Lucy.
Thank you, everyone else, for listening. Our Shelves is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Kate Maxwell. And tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.